gathering of the Klan, a gathering of technically interested, usually technically interested, although sometimes politically interested, ham radio operators at 8 o'clock Sunday night, 146.85, for as much as 4 hours. That usually runs until midnight. It's one of the longest running nets that we think is a history as far as a record breaking, so to speak, as far as the number of hours and years under primarily one group of people's control. Let me drop. So curious people gather and share information. There's a lot of hidden information with reference to electronic equipment, communication equipment. The schools do a slightly less than mediocre job of teaching RF engineering, particularly antenna RF design. They do a very poor job from my point of view compared to what they've been doing for the last 60 years. They're locked into a tradition, one particular way of teaching it. Many schools, and they're unwilling to admit that the system is not really working. You want an antenna designer, you probably have to hire a ham radio operator, a guy who's really tinkered with antennas. The schooling really doesn't teach antenna design, from my point of view, with rare exceptions. So, there are people who think that, gee, you guys keep repeating the same subjects on the TechNet. There are 5,000 kinds of antennas. So, if we 2 weeks ago discussed antennas, and last week we discussed antennas, and this week we're discussing antennas, yeah, you could say that's a duplication. But there's a lot of different ways of understanding antennas, a lot of different kinds of antennas. That's just one example. Spanning wave ratio is another. How to get maximum power out of your transmitter without exceeding its ratings. How to get maximum sensitivity out of your receiver without going through heroic efforts. What is my transmission line really doing? Should I really change the altitude of my antenna? Will I gain if I go from antenna brand A to brand B, and they're both dipoles, will I get a hell of a lot more gain out of brand B? Yes, there is no. The only way you get more gain out of an antenna is to invest in more real estate. You're going to put in more directors and reflectors and more lens. You're going to invest in more real estate. Just change brand names. It's not going to change gain. Apparent gain can go up and down when you change the altitude. And in most cases, more altitude is better. Let me drop. So there are people who ask us for our advice as to what they should do with their antenna. And when they go from antenna A to antenna B, if they go from quarter wave resonator to half wave resonator, they can make a huge improvement without requiring a whole lot of ground plane radials. If they go from 10 feet off the ground to 50 feet off the ground, they can make a huge improvement, particularly at VHF frequencies. So these are some of the things that we've discovered over the years as to general information that's usually helpful. John and I, KC2WGB, attempt to answer the questions that we can. We use the brain power that gathers at this time and try to ask people, hey, if you've got some experience in this particular area, please tell us what you know. There's a very loose schedule that the TechNet follows, which I'm going to describe to you. And that is, for the first hour, we take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. After 32 or 33 years, it's going on 33 years of the TechNet, we don't need people signing in to say that they're listening. After 33 years of continuous TechNet every single Sunday, with essentially no exception, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven. So we don't take up time with long lists of people listening. If you do have a question or a comment, please sign in with your name, your call letters, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. So during the first hour, or so, depending on how excited people get. There are people who get real upset about the fact that we allocate an hour for questions and answers, and if the subject gets really hot and heavy, we go on almost 2 hours, and people say, hey, you're off the schedule, you can't do that. We go with the flow. And if there's very few questions, we might even stop at three-quarters of an hour, if you know what I mean. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who does about three jobs. He maintains the mailbag. That really means people who don't yet have the right equipment, don't yet have the right license, but they're interested in ham radio, and they've got a question by snail mail, by internet, by whatever. They send a message to John. He collects a few of those, and the ones that have most general interest, mean? Well, by way of John monitoring Echolink and chat room, he finds out about that, and we go back to those people. So you do get handled. So John does those operations. Not sure what else he does. He just hangs around. John is a very useful guy for the last 8 or so years. I don't even know how many years he's been associated with the TechNet. My sidekick used to be K2KEY Bell, who's now a silent key from Brooklyn, from the Kings County Radio Club. Okay, that's followed by Paul, WS2N, our space expert, who tells us what the latest with NASA and similar space and astronomy-like situations. Let me drop. I suspect that Paul's contribution this week is going to be more significant than usual. You probably know that the can't even think of the name of it. Lila? No. John, what's the name of the optical
gravity wave detectors in Washington and Louisiana?
The gravity wave.
LIGO.
I said LIGO. I all of a sudden I couldn't think of LIGO. LIGO, when it went back into the most high sensitivity mode at the end of August or beginning of September, it was only on the air, so to speak, a very short period of time, and it got a blast of a signal, a chirp, both in the Livingston, Louisiana, and the Hanford, Washington facilities. Two identical facilities. Both saw the same chirp signal, a gravity wave signal, with 7 milliseconds of difference. The amount of distance between those two is around 1,887 miles, but if the signal had been coming from directly in line, there would have been 10 milliseconds. 7 milliseconds is what they saw was the difference between the two. So the fact that they saw it at 2 means it's real. So we're going to hear Paul give us quite a bit of description of the significance of gravity wave detection. Let me drop this. Each time astronomers open up a brand new portion of the spectrum, so to speak, you see brand new things. Galileo did amazing things by building himself a very crude telescope in 1612, aiming it at Jupiter, among other things. And that was the beginning of optical astronomy. Later on, we had infrared and ultraviolet optical astronomy. And eventually, we had radio astronomy and millimeter wave and low frequency and high frequency and super high frequency and X-ray. So each time you open up another window for another kind of astronomy, you make brand new discoveries about what this universe is like and where the Earth and the Sun and the solar system and our galaxy, how it all fits in. So now you get this brand new window of astronomy called a gravity wave astronomy. So we're going to be hearing a lot about that. It's a very significant opening. And believe it or not, ham radio was there. The Hulse-Taylor measurement that was done way back in, I think it was 1975. Our ham radio buddy, K1JT, Joe Taylor, was at the Astronomy Observatory in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, and he discovered a particular pulsar. The particular pulsar had a periodicity to the pulses that you receive. Let me drop. And Joe Taylor, K1JT, had discovered that the periodicity was representing the fact that that particular pulsar was in orbit around another thing, neutron star or whatever. It was in orbit around something else, so you saw the periodicity of that orbit. And a few years later, he went the next step and discovered that the rate of the periodicity was slowing down. In other words, because these two binary objects, one of which was a pulsar, were orbiting each other and sending out gravity waves, that was a method of dissipating some of their energy. Therefore, they were coming closer together. And so, therefore, the period was decreasing. And he recognized that by some very precise measurements and got a Nobel Prize for it. So, ham radio was there also. So, that was the very first discovery of the existence of gravity waves. That was the best explanation for how the energy was being dissipated. And so now, gravity waves, for the first time, have been directly measured. The Joe Taylor measurement was a kind of indirect measurement, but it was a confirmation that gravity waves are really there.
Why, David? I have a question.
Okay, we got blank 2RY, David. What's the prefix, David? Go ahead.
Kilo Golf.
Okay, Kilo Golf 2, Romeo Yankee. All right, we've got more than enough to get going. Keep going. Joe, Casey 2, Golf Yankee Whiskey. Go right ahead, Joe. And try not to stop us tonight. Go easy with us, Joe. I'm having some fun with him. You got it, Joe. K2RIW.
Hey, Roger, Roger. I'm in the mobile. My question to you, Dick, is I'm trying to, you know, get back to the game here. When I get home to the home base, it's too cold to stick out my magnet antenna. Can I stick that on my refrigerator for now and just listen in when I get back to the home base? Back to you.
Yeah, we got good news for you, Joe. You can stick that mag mount antenna of yours anywhere you want. And let me show you some of the things that people make the mistake of thinking are a restriction and they're not. For instance, when I listen to Limock in the morning, I know that Limock has a purely vertical antenna on top of the North Shore Towers in Glen Oaks. I've seen it on Google Earth. I've seen the antennas. I know they're purely vertically polarized. By the time that signal bounces through all the trees and my local water tower and whatever, by the time that signal gets to my bathroom, it's primarily horizontally polarized. I know because when I hold my handy-talkie horizontal and put it on a plastic shelf in my bathroom, that's when it gets the best reception. So a mag mount, the fact that you're mounting it horizontal versus vertical, very minor difference. The fact that you're not mounting it really high up in the air, that's a slight disadvantage. And so whether or not you decide to, at a later time, build yourself a coat hanger's inexpensive wire antenna with a SO239, if you know what I mean, with four little wires sticking out of the bottom as coat hanger wires, quarter wavelength long, and one in the center is a quarter wavelength radiator, and you mount that in the attic of your house, on the chimney of your house, and run a piece of cable down from it, and it could be a Radio Pistol 58, RG58 cable. You run that down into the house, and connect your handy-talkie to it. And even though that cable's got some loss, the fact that you're transmitting through your handy-talkie into an antenna that's greater altitude will make you 20 decibels stronger, as if you raised the power by 100 to 1. So the altitude of the antenna, let me drop this. There are three things that make a 2-meter or a VHF, UHF antenna work well. Altitude, and altitude. Those are the three things. So whether the antenna is quarter wave, 5/8, half wave, these are minor details. Whether it's horizontal or vertical, whether the mag mount is stuck to the top of the refrigerator, the side of the refrigerator, the storm window that's near the side of the apartment, the radiator, these are all minor details. And by experimentation, you can find out which ones work well with you. Another thing you'll discover is that multipath is everywhere. That VHF signal leaving Glen Oaks, coming to you from Limock, is bouncing off all kinds of things, so that if you were a long distance away so that signal was weak, or choose another repeater that's sort of weak, and you hold your handy-talkie vertical, horizontal, pointed away from you, pointed toward you, hold it up, down, left, right, forward. In other words, you move the handy-talkie in all possible directions while listening to a weak repeater signal, and you'll see peaks and valleys all over your living room, your dining room, and so on. That signal is bouncing off everything in your environment, and sometimes those bounces come out in phase at your rubber duck antenna, and you get a strong signal, sometimes out of phase. So by experimentation, by way of moving the antenna all kinds of ways, you'll find the best position. Let me drop. And one other thing you got to be careful about, the fact that you move around the antenna and you find the strongest signal when you're receiving doesn't necessarily mean that's the strongest signal when you transmit. Because you transmit 600 kc lower than you receive, and so there's a zillion wavelengths between you and the repeater on the transmit frequency, and there's a zillion and 50 wavelengths on the receiver frequency. So the way the signals come out, multipathing and peaking and valleying throughout your room, you may find out that you have to use a slightly different position for the strongest signal when you transmit, even though it might not be the place where you get the strongest receiver signal. So you've got a lot of variability here, Joe. The handy-talkie is a very rugged thing. Usually they will tolerate transmitting into a pure open circuit if you make the mistake of transmitting with a rubber duck disconnected. Let me drop. So there's no way you can double, you can, with rare exception, there's no way you can damage the handy-talkie by using a crazy antenna in a crazy position, in a crazy location, so to speak. So the transmitter is very forgiving. The receiver is very forgiving. You get away with murder in this one, Joe. It's an experimenter's paradise as to how you use your rubber duck. And even in this super cold weather, do those electrons care about the coldness? I don't think so. They're going to do their thing anyhow. So you may have some further questions on this, but not to worry about some of the things you've been worrying about there, Joe. KC2, Golf Yankee Whiskey Mobile. And well, I bet you've seen some cold weather. K2LAW, go ahead, Joe.
I have a suggestion for Joe, Dick, and Tulio.
Let me hear Joe first. Go ahead, Joe. He's mobile.
Yankee Whiskey. Cubist. Yankee Whiskey.
Yeah, go ahead, Joe. Were you going to make a comment, Joe, while you're mobile? And were you able to hear us continuously?
Hey, Roger that. Good news. Good news to me. So I don't have to go outside in the cold right now. Yeah, because I just bought a whole bunch of new equipment. And when I get back to, I'll be back to the home base in 5 minutes. I'll just hook it up on top of the refrigerator, and I'll just listen in. And then Wednesday, I'm gonna put a 2 meter. It's like a 52 inch long antenna on the car, with a new 2900 Yaesu. So yeah, so sounds good. Sounds good. Good news. And I have one of my buddies listening. He's listening on the TechNet tonight. He's a new ham operator, and so for now you can just listen in. All right, thank you guys, thank you very much, and back to you, Dick.
Joe, as you operate mobile right now, what antenna are you using mobile? It might be a rubber duck from inside the car if you're close enough to the repeater, or it might be a real mag mount or a sheet metal mounted antenna on the outside. So, how many watts are you transmitting? You're sounding very good. And what's your antenna and how many watts are you transmitting? Back to you, Joe. KC2GYW, K2LAW. Yep. Juliet Yankee Whiskey. You got it, Joe. Should have said Golf Yankee Whiskey, but you know who you are.
My trunk, and it looks like a cell phone antenna.
Way too short, way too low. signal beautifully on reception. You try to transmit through that, and it ain't going to work. Okay, I think you said you had another comment, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead.
Okay, Dick Roger, it's nothing technical, but I just hope you'll allow me. I'm sorry, but my honey bun here, Patricia's been very, very ill. They're finishing diagnostic testing, and she'll be going into the hospital for major surgery. We're all scared, especially her. So I'd like to ask the guys on frequency, I've been on here a lot, you know me, if you would possibly mail Patty a get well card. And that's all. She likes to be called Patty or Patricia. Does not like the name Pat because she said it sounds too much like a boy's name. Anyway, you can send it to my address on QRZ, and I will make sure she gets it. Just put my name, my address, attention Patty, and she'll get the card definitely. And by the way, there's a very lovely picture of the two of us in the upper right-hand corner on QRZ. Think you'll have to excuse that, but that's all I have to say. Back to Net and to Leo.
Very fine, Rich. And good luck with that operation. Let's see, Joe is the next guy, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. He's a guy who's been doing a lot of antenna experimenting these days, finding out an awful lot of what a dipole will tolerate as nearby objects, other antennas, and so on. So I wonder how those experiments are going, Joe. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Good evening. My question for this week is, what type of modulation is generally used, what is generally used for communication purposes, but is low, 30 kilohertz, like, you know, in the VLF frequency region? Back to you.
In theory, I should know something about that. I don't think I do. I was working alongside a man named Pete Seelman, a real smart antenna engineer, at the Airborne Instruments Laboratory, 25 years ago, in which we were assigned the task of building a so-called command receiver. This is something that listens to those super low frequencies that a submarine can pick up under the water. You go to a low enough, very low frequency, like 30 kc, 60 kc, 100 kc, you go to a low enough frequency with the right kind of an antenna being dragged behind the submarine, and you can be 60 feet below the salt water anywhere in the world and hear a signal. And to my knowledge, that signal that was being transmitted was simple on-off keying, Morse code, very slow speed Morse code. That was the signal that we were advised at that time. Whether or not they'd come up with more sophisticated techniques of phase shift keying, quadrature phase shift keying, 16 QAM, and all these other modulations, I think the answer is no. And the reason for that is that that medium they're transmitting through at these super low frequencies is quite dispersive. In other words, the way the signal bounces off the ionosphere, and I'm using the word bounce in quotes because the signal doesn't really bounce. It refracts off the ionosphere, but it looks like a bounce. So the signal is bouncing off water, ionosphere, water, like land, penetrating the water, getting to that antenna. I think the only thing that they can trust that gives them the lowest possible sensitivity, because it's a super weak signal when it gets there. Let me drop it. It's on-off keying. That gives you the most narrow signal with the best possible threshold. Frequency shift keying and other more elaborate modulation techniques take up more bandwidth. They're going to therefore suffer from the dispersion. Dispersion is the word I'm looking for. In other words, the way the signal propagates is going to change as you shift in frequency. If I transmitted an amplitude-modulated tone, for instance, you've got an upper side below that's higher in frequency, a lower side low that's lower in frequency, the main carry in the middle is right on frequency, and those three frequencies are going to propagate differently, and some of those are going to drop out and others don't, and so sending more elaborate modulation, I can see some huge bunch of guesses based on a very small amount of experience a whole lot of years ago. And if anyone else has got more recent experience and more direct experience, let that person give us his call letters right now. So the B2RYY, let's pick it up with some delay. K2RYW in the tech net.
VDH with a comment.
Mr. VDH, give us your full call and name. I should tell you very well. Go right ahead.
Yeah, fine business. The call is WA2VDH. Name is John. Yeah, just as a comment on the very low frequency communications. Now this is going back about 15 years when I used to have my my monstrous RBA5 receiver that I somehow managed to get home from Cortlandt Street years and years ago. Anyway, I do remember monitoring, I think it was NAA, around 19 or 20 kilohertz. It was one of those low-frequency submarine communication stations, and they were running extremely narrow shift RDTY. I think the shift was something like maybe less than 60 hertz. I don't think the speed was any greater than maybe 50 bits per second, but it was extremely narrow shift, and it was in the vicinity of 19 kilohertz, somewhere in that region. Go ahead.
Interesting information, John. 19 kilohertz carrier frequency, very narrow shift keying, like 60 hertz. What was the keying rate? What was the data rate or board rate, if you happen to remember, John? Go right ahead.
I wasn't able to decode it because it was thoroughly encrypted, but it was definitely less than 50 bits per second, because I know what 50 bit or 50 board RDTY sounds like, and it was definitely slower than that. As I said, extremely narrow shift.
So I understand you correctly. It could have been, let's pick a number, 20 or 30 hertz of board rate. So by making the data rate so slow, you pick up a lot more sensitivity. The signal occupies a lot less frequency bandwidth. Therefore, with the proper kind of a receiver, you now have a maximum sensitivity.
Dipole. There was no special cut antenna for that frequency. As I said, with this particular receiver, you might be familiar with the RBA5. It's a monstrous thing. Pretty much any antenna I put on it would work, but of course I didn't have the room for anything that would be right for those frequencies. But the signal was strong. It was definitely well above the noise. And there were other very slow shift or very narrow shift RDTY signals in that vicinity. This receiver was capable of tuning down to about 15 kilohertz. It covered low frequency, essentially 15 kilohertz to 600 kilohertz. As a matter of fact, one experiment I did, I put an audio detector on the antenna terminal and blew a dog whistle, and it was able to get the receiver to respond. But the signal was definitely above the noise, and a fairly strong signal. And at that time, I was in St. Albans. Go ahead.
Now, I picked up my handheld calculator just to do a fun back of the envelope calculation, so to speak. Assuming the carrier was at 20 kilohertz. I know you said it was 17. 20 kilohertz would be a wavelength of 9.3 miles. Half wavelength would be 4.66 miles. I know your half wave dipole was
I say each leg was about 30, 40 feet. So an extremely short antenna. Hi, hi.
Which again demonstrates a principle that I've been saying for some time. A receiver is amazingly tolerant of a very poor antenna. In the case of 20 kilohertz like reception, the QR Nancy, the atmospheric noise on that band is so loud that that's what you're competing with. You're not competing with the microvolts of sensitivity of your receiver and the noise figure of your receiver per se. So as you use a really yucky antenna that's 10 or 20 dB below normal performance because it's too short, non-resonant, and so on, which means, let's assume the antenna is 20 dB low in performance compared to a real full half-wave dipole resonated, and your antenna wasn't resonated. So you're losing 20 dB, which means you get 20 dB less atmospheric noise, 20 dB less signal. The signal-to-noise ratio stays the same, just the signal transmitter doesn't go up as high. And that that receiver, I am guessing it had a tuning mechanism in the front end, John, so that a non-resonant antenna could at least be brought into partial resonance. I bet it had some kind of a tuning mechanism where the receiver tried to make up electronically for some of the length that wasn't there for the real antenna. I wonder if that's true, John. W2VDH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, yeah, well, a few words about the RBA-5. It was a TRF receiver. As a matter of fact, if you look on the net, there are a few places where you'll see a picture of it. It was built for, as I say, shipboard use. It's a monstrous thing. It must weigh about, about 150, 160 pounds. But it is a purely TRF receiver. As far as the input, it does have an input matching control on it for trying to achieve some type of match with various antennas. Just as a point of information also, the November-December issue of QEX from 2015 has an article on there about reception of WWVB at 60 kilohertz for use as a frequency standard. That's the November-December 2015 QEX. That article might be of interest if somebody has interest in low-frequency reception. Go ahead.
How do you do, Jack? Very fine, John. Eric, I wonder how much reception you've done way down there. And I make a joke about when you go so high in frequency, you can get a nosebleed. What happens when you go that low? Go ahead, Eric. K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. Well, I had a 60 kilohertz receiver on my wrist. If you've ever seen what's called an atomic clock or an atomic set clock, is a 60 kilohertz receiver actually in the watch. And usually late at night, it will start to pick up the 60 kilohertz signal. And the actual baud rate of the time signal that's embedded in there is around 110 baud. And it accurately sets the watch. So, and it works very well. And it's from WWVB. There's also a 60 kilohertz signal on the island of Kauai, which is actually WWVH. WWVHB is also a 60 kilohertz synchronous with the one in Fort Collins and the one in Kauai. K2RW, K2J.
Eric, that 60 kilohertz signal that gets to your watch and really disciplines it to have the right timing. You told us the baud rate, I think you said it's 110 hertz baud rate or something like that. What is the modulation method, if you happen to know, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's NRZ. It's a non-return to zero. It's, now you can think of it as phase modulation.
Okay. Would you call that biphase? In other words, it's essentially flipping between zero and 180 degrees of phase? Or is it, quad phase? Do you believe it's a two-phase?
Well, you can think of it this way. If a period for one is, say, 1 millisecond, a period for zero would be 2 milliseconds, if you want to think of it that way.
That's the timing of the signal. But the 1 millihertz of something, 1 millisecond of something, or 0.5 milliseconds of something, is the modulation within that period. 180 degree phase shift. Over to you, Eric.
Okay. Actually, I'm looking it up. That's the HF. The HF is based on number of cycle. Let's see, a tick is on WWB. It's 5 milliseconds. It consists of 1,000 cycle tone, but that's not what we're looking for. Minute, and I'll find it. It's specific. Okay. I can't locate it here. Let's think of it as, give me a minute. I'll give you an exact answer.
Yeah, take your time on that, Eric. And when you find it, you can come back and interrupt what we're doing. I wonder if you've done some listening down there, Rich, and the actual modulation, did it sound to you like a radio teletype, frequency shift keying, 180 degree phase shift? What did it sound like to you, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, I haven't done any listening down there, but I have a couple of suggestions. I used to own a Collins R390A receiver. It's a wonderful receiver. It doesn't go quite that low, but it's counterpart. Maybe Eric knows the number. It's called an R380, I believe, but I'm not sure. And there's a fellow, Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. I don't remember his call. You can look him up by name. His name is Howard Mills. And he does restoration on Collins A-Line, 75A4s, R390s, or the other receivers, the number I don't remember. But he does a wonderful, wonderful job. He did for me. Then we silk screens, the front panels, paints everything. And we does the electronics completely. The only thing is he's not cheap. Back to that, M2EO.
I got the answer, Dick.
Go right ahead, Eric.
All right, K2RW, K2J. It's kind of funky way of doing it. What they do is they transmit amplitude modulation at 18%, 100 hertz subcarrier is the main signal. That is, in addition to a low-level 100 hertz tone, they transmit the same framework of Eric G. If you know GPS, that's the format. And it's sent as binary coded decimal. Each digit is sent as a 2 or 3, 4 bits, 2, 3, or 4 bits, depending upon the value. The 100 hertz subcarrier transmitted at minus 15 dBFS, that's full scale, beginning at 30 milliseconds from the start of the second tick. So you have the second tick as a reference for decoding. And then it's reduced to 3% modulation of minus 30 dBFS one or two, three times within a second. The duration of the high amplitude subcarrier encodes a data bit, a data bit as one, or as a marker. If the subcarrier is reduced to 800 milliseconds, past the second, this indicates a marker. If the subcarrier is reduced 500 milliseconds, past the second, this indicates a data bit with a value of 1. The subcarrier is reduced 200 milliseconds past the second. It indicates a data bit with a value of 0. So we're basically talking about AM and its period, or its duration past the reference.
So I'm going to try to review what I think I just heard. The main RF carrier, 60 kilohertz. in amplitude, 15 dB down or 30 dB down, but the 100 hertz subcarrier, called a 100 hertz tone, is changed in amplitude with various kinds of timing synchronized to the second, which tells you ones and zeros. So it's the amplitude modulation of the 100 hertz tone, or call it subcarrier, which is the real modulation. Is that close to correct, Eric? K2EJ, K2LIW?
That's correct, and the decoding is started by the five cycles of 1,000 hertz that makes the pick. Let's see, what else do we have here? But that's essentially correct. And then, according to the timing and its position, you get the actual bit numbers, all based upon the start of the thing. The once per second ticks, minute and hour tones are modulated onto the carrier at 100% or 0 dBc. And the time codes and audio codes are modulated at 50%, which is, okay, and it says the maximum data for WWB. Okay. Yes, you're basically correct with a reference to, say, the modulation starts here.
When I listen to National Bureau of Standards, WWB, on either 2.5, 5, 10, 15 megahertz with my timing receiver, you hear a continuous tone with ticks. Da, 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 is what it sounds like. And so, depending on whether or not it's an odd-numbered minute or an even-numbered minute, the continuous tone you hear in the background is either 600 hertz or 440 hertz, odd versus even. I keep forgetting which is which. When it comes to the timing that your watch is picking up at 60 kilohertz, and it's listening to a 100 hertz tone with various kinds of timing, that's amazing that that little chip with that really yucky 60 kilohertz antenna inside your watch is looking for that 100 hertz subcarrier and looking at the timing of that to derive the digits of encoding of timing in order for the watch to decide to set itself faster or slower. Can you imagine if you and I built that with discrete circuits in 1970? It would fill up half a table. And all of that is probably in a couple of millimeter chip inside of your watch. KE2EJ, we've come a long way. K2RIW, the tech man.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Now, if you remember Bill Baker, I started him with it, and I think the first time, I think I had bought that watch in 96 or 95, so. And actually, the antenna is in the wristband, which is interesting. You know, it's a big freaking coil wire that's inside the wristband, but the actual IC that does the job is very tiny.
On most watches that I've ever owned, there is a spring bar pin that goes between the watch and the wristband that you have to compress in order to change the band. I keep my watches so long that I end up buying two or three wristbands for it. My favorite watch these days is a diesel watch because I like the looks and got great big hands and easy to read. But I've got to keep changing the wristband. And how in the world did they get that connection between the watch, past that spring bar, into the wristband? And that wristband itself, with its coil in the wristband, really is picking up the signal from your body. Your body, Eric, is the real antenna. That's just a coupling mechanism. How in the world did they accomplish that? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Now, first of all, when the receiver actually becomes active, it's usually when you have your watch on a desk or by a window or something like that. And they'll tell you in some places you'll get better receptions than others. The actual connectivity between the wristband and the watch case itself has a contact on that pin that expands, and there's one on each side, and that's how they make the electrical connection. The receiver itself is inside the body of the watch.
Did the watch recommend that you take it off at night and put it near a window in order to make sure you get it reset? that if you wore it all night long, the resetting function might not work quite as well. Did the instructions of the watch say anything along those lines, Eric? K2LAW.
Yeah, the watch recommends, in their literature, they recommend, by a window up high. If you're on a multi-level house, the higher you get it, the better. Away from, I suppose I could read it, although I don't have it handy. It makes a number of different recommendations. And you can actually see the little field strength indicator on the front of the watch to tell you when it's actually picking stuff up.
That's quite a watch. Way back then, roughly how many dollars and what brand name? And does that watch still exist, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, they still manufacture them. That one was a Junger, which I think was made in Germany. But you can do a Google search for atomic clocks, and you'll find wall clocks and all sorts of stuff that have the receivers in it to set the time of the clock or the watch. And it's still being manufactured, so it's, it's a technology that continues onward.
And what accuracy do they claim? Always accurate to the nearest small fraction of a second? 24 hours a day, 365 days a year? Is that the approximate accuracy they claim, Eric?
No, let's put it this way. Bill Baker and I would come in with our watches, and we'd sit down in front of the atomic clocks that we actually had at the station, and we would check it against the USNO, and also what we got, and the NIST. Although you're doing it by eyeball, it looks like the seconds ticked exactly when the tick came by. So it was pretty damn accurate.
I keep forgetting, was this call letters K1BKR or something like that? What is Bill, who used to be the president of Channel 13 locally, what's Bill doing these days? I haven't heard him on the air. Go ahead, Eric.
At about 7 o'clock in the morning, you can find him at 3835 on 80 meters. He is now a professor at St. John's and also at, not Columbia, another one of the universities. He's actually teaching for three different universities. And also, he's very actively involved in bunch of other things. Plus, he's still the president emeritus of WNET, so when you see Metro Focus come on the air and you listen to the voiceover, you hear Bill's voice, and it's W1BKR.
Interesting. Okay. The good old days of the ham radio operator that was the president of Channel 13. And now we have a ham radio operator that is the chief engineer. Channel 13 and Channel 21, who you just heard. So those super low frequency transmitters and receivers, the transmitting antenna on that is a real nightmare to transmit a lot of signal at those super low frequencies with reasonable efficiency. In some cases, the antennas are multiple miles long. So the Jim Creek antenna in Tennessee, I think, was literally strung between mountains in order to have reliable communication to submarines in those days. Another one of these crazy frequency areas. I'm dreaming about going super high in frequency. And there you are on these super low frequencies. You and I are on the opposite ends of the spectrum, Joe. WA2RYY. K2RIW in the tech net. Look what you got us into tonight.
Experiment and trio.
Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, last question with my receiver, the receiver doesn't go that low, so I can't actually listen to stuff that was said that far, but I know from the Electronics Magazine years ago, they mentioned something about some antenna and coupler main that operates on 17.8 kilohertz. It always made me wonder what kind of modulation is used on those frequency centers, because obviously the wavelength is tremendous, and any kind of modulation that you produce in that, if any kind of bandwidth at all, would increase your return loss as you modulate. And either side you carry it, so it made me wonder what do you really do if you'd be able to get the message from point A to point B. And I do hear a lot of stuff with RIDI signals on, I'll give you one frequency, for example, it comes very strong for me, about 293 kilohertz. but I don't know the bandwidth, but I can hear it on my TS-690. It goes Lisa. There's a bunch of frequencies down there, but 293 is about the strongest one I hear. I don't know what that's all about either.
What are you using as a receiving antenna, Joe?
The long wire antenna I strung up in the backyard about a couple of months ago. It's like about 60 feet of wire from just the top of the house over to a pole, supporting pole, and it goes down and just runs along the fence, so to speak. But that gives me a tremendous amount of signal, incoming signal, a lot stronger than I've ever had before.
And you have some kind of an impedance matching device. It's essentially an NZEPT or a L antenna, NZEPT. Any impedance matching, or does the receiver you're using have a impedance matching network built into the front end, a tuner of some kind?
You always speak about impedance matching. No, I didn't match any impedances at all. Nothing at all. And the receiver only has a tuner for transmitting purposes from 80 meters on up, so what you put in the receiver is what you see is what you get.
Once again, this is one of those situations where it's pretty strong evidence that the receiver is very forgiving. And by the way, whenever I say impedance matching, in some cases I really mean resonating, even without impedance matching. If I built myself a 80-meter dipole on half wavelength, 60 feet in the air, 132 feet of 16-gauge wire, and if my property is so small that instead of making it 132 feet long, I made it 32 feet long, you would think that would be a terrible antenna. As long as you do something to resonate that antenna, you'll get full performance within 0.45 dB, within less than half a dB of loss. And it's not loss of efficiency, it's loss of pattern gain. Once you resonate that quarter length half wave dipole, a quarter of the real length, you'll get full performance out of it. So resonating is the most important thing. Impedance matching of the resistive component that's left is the second most important thing. And receivers, even if you do none of that, in many cases are extremely forgiving. Wonder what you used as an antenna to listen to those super low frequencies, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW, the TechNet.
My comment was something different, Dick. What I wanted to tell Joe, if he's looking for a clock, MFJ makes one. I hope they still make it. I don't remember the model number. I'd have to go in another room and look. But they call it an eternity clock for whatever reason. It's got batteries in there, and it also runs off solar cells. It goes over the solar cells when there's enough light. Very, very nice. About $100, a little pricey, but it's got very, very large liquid crystal digits that are easily read. It's got seconds on it. It's got everything one would need. It even has an indicator to show when it's locked to WWVB. It's very, very nice. We have two of them here, and they're very nice. And maybe Eric knows the model number of that receiver. Like I said, it looks like a Collins R390, but instead of the R390's frequency range, it goes down way, way down low in frequency. So maybe Joe would be interested in one of those. If we know the model number, he could probably find one on eBay. Back to Ned.
Yeah, interesting to know that MFJ makes such a product. Thank you for that information. Next guy on our list was John, KD2IXP. And I know, John, you've been putting forth quite an effort to ship to KD2WGB and me. I know you want to ship some very nice files, which go into a fair number of megabits. I know you've had quite a bit of trouble doing that. So, and it's not easy. So, by one means or another, there must be a way of doing it. And maybe the file can be compressed before shipment, although that represents some problems. And my crazy system, which is a Unix, it's Unix. I keep forgetting the, it's a Unix, is my actual system. And there's an amazing number of things that people try to ship to me that I'm unable to open. We prefer not to be using a Microsoft or a Windows type of data. And the problem I'm running into these days is I used to be able to get the digital version of QST Magazine. Either ARRL changed the method by which they sent it, or there's some change in my system. And I know that Adobe Acrobat PDF Reader is something that my very security conscious son does not want to install on our system because it's too easily hacked. So maybe that's what ARRL is using. Whatever ARRL is now using and whatever we are using, I no longer can open up the digital mode of the over-the-air, the over-the-network mode of QST Magazine. I used to be able to get QST Magazine earlier and read it. I no longer can. Maybe somebody knows what's going on there, but when it comes to...
Repeater, timeout.
Last time you updated Java on your browser.
If I update Java, I think you're saying probably it's been a while. If I update Java, I think you're saying it might work. And the Java update, how good is that on hacker security from your knowledge? Eric, go ahead.
It's updated constantly. When they find a vulnerability, they fix it rather rapidly. Actually, I believe the ARRL uses the PDF, but it's Java that actually directs the browser to go and open it, so you may have an older version.
Okay, so I've got two questions on that one. What Java?